guess. And then Rasa came walking in.
And I said, we don't care about him. Okay, so this is the last official. It's the last official. Don't you have one more Bhagavad Gita book?
Yeah, but this is the last lecture, formal lecture.
That's last formal lecture.
Yeah, last formal lecture.
Okay, of the for Dr. Sangeeta Menon. And she is. Oops. I took up the wrong description. What institution are you in again?
It's right. Well, I can tell about myself.
I have your name.
Oh, thank you very much. So, Sangeeta.
Yes.
The concept of constant. National Institute for Advanced Studies in Bangalore and connected with Mysore University. She does supervision of higher degrees for them. But uniquely, practically, has degrees in science and philosophy. And this is the interesting aspect. This is what was very interesting for us in her application for a fellowship, because very few people are in on the Indian side are dealing with this subject in such a comprehensive way. Mm. And because she's connected with science and philosophy, she's going to expand upon the concept of consciousness from this perspective. So this is it's very important. We're very, very happy to have her here, beginning to open herself up to a whole new audience, a whole new world, indeed. So, Sangeeta, thank you very much.
Thank you, Shaunaka. In fact, I'm grateful to Shaunaka Rishidas and Gavin Flood for having me here in this wonderful center, and I'm really honored to give these lectures here. Very thankful to you, Shaunaka.
Thank you.
And I know that you're busy. And thank you all friends for coming from very different places. Thanks Ken, Hillary, Shirley, Trevor, and all other friends who are here. Well, brain studies, cognitive sciences, and culture studies in the last 10 years have jointly redefined the complex nature of consciousness. And this redefinition has brought two issues in the forefront. And these two issues are, one is the approach to consciousness. How do you approach consciousness studies? Would the approach make a difference in its understanding? And the second issue is the subjective nature of consciousness. When consciousness got back into the discussion in the context of many sciences, interestingly, this aspect has now come up with much emphasis. And this particularly happened, as many of you would know, when David Chalmers published his famous paper, The Puzzle of Conscious Experience, in the Scientific American in 1995, where he proposed a serious challenge. And the challenge was that what we have in front of brain studies are two kinds of problems. And the first set of problems, he named them as the easy problems with the plural. And the second, he said, is a single problem, and he called as the hard problem. Perhaps I might be repeating what many of you would know, but still I think this would be important in our whole discussion. He said that there is a distinction between being conscious and what is responsible for consciousness. Well, Bacon and Descartes would have anticipated such a dualistic trend in understanding mind-body problem, but in Chalmers' paper, this was much more precise. He said that what you call as the easy problems are how different neural processes constitute the different experiences. And he lists a few, such as how can we discriminate sensory stimuli and react to them appropriately? How does brain integrate information from different sources and use this information to control behavior? How is that we can visualize our own internal states? And so on. And he said that the easy problems are quite complex, but the blessing is that with advancements in brain studies, in brain mapping equipment, and so on, and neuroscience and neuropsychology, perhaps one day we would have approximate answers to many of these questions. But then he said that there's a further problem, which is the heart problem. The heart problem is, how is that the neural processes that are physical give rise to a subjective experience which is non-physical? And this he called as the heart problem. And with this introduction of a dualistic trend again in this century, Chalmers initiated a whole lot of discussion on the subjective nature of consciousness and what is responsible for the subjective nature of consciousness. This further initiated many discussions, particularly what is called as the binding problem. Binding problem again is very interesting. Binding problem is, how is that physical, neural, discrete, physical, discrete, quantitative neural processes and functions give rise to unitary, subjective, non-physical, qualitative, subjective experience? How could something completely physical and quantitative and discrete give rise to something else which is non-physical, which is unitary, and which is of subjective nature? And this is a kind of a magic. How can something very much neural give rise to an I experience? This is called as the binding problem. How does the different neural processes bind together to give a unitary subjective experience? Now, to turn our attention a little bit on the part of our body which we all have very intact, which is the brain, that weighs about just about 3 pounds and has about 100 billion neurons, each of which having thousands of interconnections with other neurons. And all this setup somehow mysteriously producing different kinds of responses to our experiences, summoning memories and thoughts, all that which is unique to us. It's interesting that also that brain is a very plastic organ. As we learn, there are more connections made, there are more firings happening, and so on. Also, we know that a huge amount of nerve endings is in our lips, fingertips, thumb and back, and some of this could be responsible for the immense social and cultural evolution that we as humans seen. And another interesting thing is that in distinction from other organs in our body, when you do something, it's not that one part of the brain reacts. It's possible that many parts of the brain might be doing a lot of parallel processing even when you do a little bit of small thing. So it's a big world. To come back to the binding problem and the binding experiences has been the most important issue for many different disciplines to come together to understand consciousness, like crossing disciplines like neurobiological, quantum mechanical, computational, psychological, etc. But what brought all these disciplines so varied in their method and approach together is that there is a consensus that to explain consciousness is pretty much to explain conscious experience. And to explain experience is to explain its unity and binding nature. So this is what has brought many different disciplines together to think conjointly about subjective nature of something which is completely otherwise neural. Now, friends, let's talk a little bit about experience. What do we mean by experience? Well, it could mean many things, but let me give you a bit of a technical definition to experience, or more or less trying to get many different views on experience. In commonsensical way of understanding experience, experience could mean having a sense of meaning, enriched with emotions, a first-person, what I would like to call as a first-person intimacy, and then the ability to report about it in cognitive terms. Well, experience could well mean a whole lot of other things too. If you look at day-to-day experience, we talk about basic emotions like love, jealousy, happiness, pain, passion, insecurities, fear, anger, and so on. Again, values, worldviews, attitudes, perception, responses, memory, and how we see ourselves. All this could constitute what we address in general as day-to-day experiences. Then there is another set of experience, which I term as our experiences, which perhaps you might, some of you would have a different term for it. But this could include psychological and neural experiences of different kinds, experiences due to different brain impairments, like some of this, like synesthesia, which is, if people would know, synesthesia, like tasting sounds, hearing colors. They're wonderful experiences. And many of these interesting experiences, technically called syndromes, are explained in Vilayanu Ramachandran's book, The Phantoms in the Brain. He talks also about many different syndromes, like I wouldn't go into the detail of it, but like, for example, Capgras syndrome, where when a person who suffers from Capgras syndrome, he wouldn't be able to recognize his own image, which means he is not able, he doesn't have self-recognition. And to worsen it, he wouldn't be able to recognize another person. The third set of experiences could be together called as the inexplicable experiences, constituted by psychedelic experiences, drug, religious, aesthetic, mystic, meditative, and spiritual experiences. In fact, a whole new brand, a new discipline has emerged, again, many of you would know, called as the neurotheology, very controversial. People get very heated up when they talk about it for several reasons. But very interesting to look at even this discipline carefully. One of the arguments of neurotheology is that people who have undergone temporal lobe epilepsy have more prone to mystic experiences. So it's interesting to look at the mystics all over the world. But it's not necessary, it's not saying that mystic experience is equivalent to temporal lobe epileptic expressions and so on. But what it means is that perhaps you could have a location in the brain for the so-called mystic experiences. And interestingly, I remember Dawkins saying that, he admitting that the interesting thing is about human beings is not the belief in God, but the capacity to believe in God, and that could be of evolutionary advantage. Not necessarily the belief in God, but the capacity we have to believe in God, could be of evolutionary advantage. At least he admits that much. Well, perhaps because of this intricacy and complexity of what we otherwise call as the innocent experience, there are three approaches to understand consciousness. This is in the mainstream study of consciousness. The first set of approaches are called as the first-person approach, and as the term itself suggests, it's beginning from the first person. And these approaches would focus on health, well-being, spiritual exploration, meditative experiences, near-death experiences, and so on. And on the other side of the spectrum comes the third-person approach. These approaches are interested primarily in locating the different cortical areas in your brain that are responsible for the different sensations and perceptions you have. And they are also interested in giving you pure causal theories in the classical sense. Okay, this is responsible for this kind of a conscious experience. They are also interested in reducing whatever you call as subjective or experiential to what they would call as neural information, or chemical, neurochemical information, to be precise. Well, it looks like these are two sides of a spectrum and kind of a huge world in between. So how do we bring in these two sides of the spectrum? Perhaps this is the reason people like Patricia Churchill and Susan Blackmore and many others got quite excited. And even Journal of Consciousness Studies devoted an issue on what is called as the intersubjective approach to consciousness, or the second person approach to consciousness. These approaches are interested in intersubjective. They focused on values, empathy, neurophilosophy, what is technically called as neurophilosophy, memetic studies, the understanding of mirror neurons, qualia, and so on. This you could see as a trend to interrelate the first person and the second person approach, and also an understanding that consciousness cannot be completely defined by empirical standards, and at the same time, it cannot be completely understood, underlined by first-person experience, because first-person experience is more experiential, and it reports your personal experience. So technically, it cannot be understood in more scientific sense. So perhaps the second-person approach, or the approaches that focus on intersubjectivity, inspired by this idea. Now, we could also locate two trends in consciousness studies based on all these issues. The first trend goes to perhaps a classical time, you know, Descartes or even William James and so on, which are the dualistic trend. And this trend focuses on explanation and the object. And they are interested in bringing forth new explanatory puzzles. And the latest, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that which introduced by David Chalmers, the heart problem. So this could be called as the dualistic trend, and which is also the trend which initiated the scientific renaissance for all of us. The second could be called as the syncretic trend, which is more experience and person-oriented. In the when you compare these two trends, there is a shift of focus from a basic classical mind-body dualism to consciousness-brain-experience syncretism. Now, friends, let's ask some basic questions when we have to understand consciousness, because though consciousness is a very highly technical topic today, all of us are interested in the subject, and we all feel that, okay, I have a say about it. I have a say about it, and I wish to know more about it, but I do have a say about it because I own at least a little bit of it. So what are the questions inspired by this very exciting field, especially in this century, and I'm sure for many more years to come? What could be the basic questions to understand consciousness, you know, if you keep apart all these technical very, very precise ways of looking at consciousness? What could be the basic questions that could be asked by a professional as well as day-to-day, a commoner? The first question is, of course, a definition-oriented. This is, what is consciousness? What exactly do we mean by consciousness? And this is very interesting, friends, because when you ask this question, you understand that people who approach consciousness studies approach consciousness with very different definitions, though there is a kind of a grantedness that we are all looking at something which is very common. But when you look at the varied definitions, you understand that the approach itself could be related to one specific part of our issue about consciousness. The second question, I term this as the 5 W questions. These are 5 questions which starts with W. The second is, where is consciousness? There are many people, like neuroscientists, neuropsychologists, who are interested in locating consciousness. In fact, philosophers, ancient and modern, are interested in locating consciousness. It could be some cortical regions of the brain. It could be the purest, innocent Atman of ourself. But where is consciousness? A location for consciousness. This is another question which is asked pan-disciplines. The third is, when did it happen? Did consciousness have a particular time in an evolutionary scale, or evolutionary scale in a scientific sense as well as in a mystical sense? So do we understand consciousness as something which is very given to some privileged people, or is it something which we can talk about in a very ordinary context? The fourth is, again, a question asked by people like Patricia Churchland, or people who are interested more in an evolutionary biology point of view, like Susan Blackmore, many others, like, why did it happen at all? Why did consciousness happen at all? Perhaps we can get away with not having consciousness at all. Perhaps it is just an idea that helps us to understand many other discrete processes in the evolutionary scale. So perhaps consciousness is not a thing, but it is a concept which we have evolved. So perhaps we can get rid of consciousness and understand many other things. There's no need of consciousness. There's another very important issue. Yes. The fifth question, which I personally consider as the most important question in order to understand consciousness, whichever discipline it is who is talking? Who is talking about consciousness? Or who is trying to understand consciousness? Because, friends, here is one topic without a personal involvement, without a subjective intervention. You can never get the tip of it. Because the moment you try to understand it, you are trying to be part of it, you are trying to influence it, and also you are trying to make yourself a larger area of what you are trying to understand. It is perhaps because of such a complexity of consciousness, that it includes subjective nature of the person who is investigating, that the basic framework to understand consciousness may have to include three factors. One, of course, you cannot get away with it. You need the brain, because a whole lot of things happening in medical science, a whole lot of people benefited by advancements in brain studies and brain mapping equipment, which was not possible perhaps 10, 15 years before. So a whole lot of advancement in brain studies, which helps you to get the empirical and physical correlates of different conscious experience, whether it be odd, day-to-day, or mystical. And the second in this framework is experience. When you try to understand consciousness, it is very important that we consider experience, because without even looking at experience, it's impossible to look at consciousness. Even if you would admit only visual experience or a particular perception, it still demands that experience forms a very integral part to understand consciousness. And the third in this framework is being, B with the B capital, being, which we could understand as experiencer, or my favorite description for that is a first person intimacy. And some of the classical Indian theories have perfected the art of refining the first person intimacy. And it is at this point I would shift my discussion to some part of Indian ways of looking at consciousness. And I know that this is like trying to say that, okay, I am trying to bring you the Atlantic Ocean in this test tube. I know that it's impossible, and to class the whole lot of Indian theories, it's impossible. But I'm trying to see some of very basic trends, which may not be contested by however different the theory is. So when you look at the Indian theories or Indian ways to approach consciousness, I'm sure this might be true with many other Eastern traditions. I'm not saying that Indian theories are unique, but many Eastern traditions might have such a similar approach. But since our discussion is on Indian approaches, I would focus on that. If you look at the Indian ways of looking at consciousness, you see that, as I said earlier, there is a conscious effort to refine the first-person intimacy. How can you get closer and closer and closer to what you call as the pure innocence of your heart, or the pure space where you can experience all this variety and discreteness in not just in a singularity, but in a dynamic relationship. This could be one reason that if you look at many of these theories, at first, one of the trend is to say that there is the subject, and there's a subjective world, and there is the objective world. There is an experience, there is an experiencer. You have a content of experience, and you have something or somebody that experiences the experience. And he or she is called as the experiencer, who reports what is experienced. That's where you're able to reflect. It's not that we experience and forget about it. We can memorize it, we can report it, and then we can learn from it. So there is a distinction of the experience and the experiencer. And some of these expressions are more nicely put in Sanskrit, like in the, for example, in the Gita as the Kshetra and the Kshetrajna. All that which is experienced or objectified can be put under the Kshetra, that which will decay one day, and the Kshetrajna, that which knows the Kshetra. And in another classification, Drishya and the Drik, all that which can be seen, not just with your eyes, but with the mind, all that which can be again seen, and therefore other than you, which is the Drishya, and that which sees is the Drik, which cannot be the seen. And another Rigvedic distinction between Krud and Manisha, emotion and intelligence, if that translation is okay. Charaka Samhita brings a distinction between Manas and Chitta. Why I'm trying to give you some of this basic distinction is to tell you that the first trend is to make a distinction. Okay, there is the subjective world and there's the objective world. So a basic duality is still a part of Indian way of looking at it. We cannot deny that. And another instance is from the Aitareya Upanishad, where there's a distinction between Pratnya, knower, Pratnya, intellect, and Pratnyana, cognition. And perhaps inspired by the same idea that Kena Upanishad starts a psychological inquiry, as you know, that Keneshidam Abhadati Preshidam Mana. How is that the mouth, eye, and ear enabled to speak, see, and hear? I like a very nice definition which Shankaracharya gives to consciousness in his commentary to Chandogya Upanishad. He gives a nice description as Pradi Bodha Viditam, that which is known through every awareness. Pradi Bodha Viditam. What we have to keep in mind at this discussion is that there is a detachment that is encouraged to develop towards what is objective, and an engagement towards what is subjective. And all these trends encourages you to that. First see what is subjective, what is objective, and then understand yourself as not that belonging to that whole group of objectivity. So there is a detachment which is encouraged. Perhaps a little worried about such a detachment, Abhinavagupta, the 10th century Shaivite scholar, came and thought about it. Perhaps you need this kind of a dualistic approach, however hidden it is, may not be so good. So he said something very interesting in Tantraloka, which is, I would read the Sanskrit as well because it's very nice. Tadahi madure gide sparshe va chandanadige madhyati avagame yasau hrudaye spandana manada ananda shakti shaivokta yada sahrudayo jana. When the ears are filled with the sound of sweet song, or the nostrils with the scent of sandalwood, the state of indifference, non-participation, or detachment drops, disappears, and the heart is invaded by a state of vibration. Such a state is precisely the so-called power of beatitude, thanks to which the human is gifted with the heart, the sakhrudaya. It's very interesting that Abhinavagupta very cleverly breaks that gap, or tries to break the gap between what you could call as a pure objective world and a pure subjective world, because he is a champion of bringing together things which are lying here and there. He's a mastermind to bring together things. So I find Abhinavagupta as a kind of a bridge builder, and especially a person who gives immense thinking to a basic underlying dualistic thinking in Indian approaches. again, when you come to contemporary times, one of the approaches which are very interesting, I'm sure there are many, many, many others, but I wish to quote something from Ramana Maharshi of Tiruvannamalai. And this is a quote from Paul Brunton in A Search in Secret India, and he paraphrases Ramana Maharshi. This is Ramana Maharshi's words paraphrased. The first and foremost of all thoughts, the primeval thought in the mind of every person is the thought, I. It's only after the birth of this thought that any other thoughts can arise at all. It's only after the first personal pronoun, I, has arisen in the mind that the second personal pronoun, you, can make its appearance. If you could mentally follow the I thread until it led you back to its source, you would discover that just as it is the first thought to appear, so it is the last to disappear. Friends, I think with these kind of a trends and approaches or basic philosophies underlying Indian ways of understanding consciousness, what is emphasized is the presence of layers of awareness as far as the self-identity is concerned. And then there is an attempt to sieve that which is pure and irreducible from these layers of awareness. To develop a theory that says that everything else has arisen from that pure, irreducible space, and everything else stays there, and finally it gets into that irreducible space. Perhaps this is a way to break the subject-object dichotomy, which is so much present in a scientific or an object-oriented or an explanation-oriented approach to understand consciousness. Such an approach of looking at these layers of awareness and then trying to place self-identity there also helps you to progressively refine the different layers of self-awareness. Your own awareness get refined in the process. And that's why it's called as a personal exploration. Before I conclude, I wish to also give you a peek into the Yoga Sutras, because there could be many different traditions that could be discussed when you discuss about Indian theory of consciousness. But I thought to focus on Yoga Sutras would be appropriate this evening. Just to focus on a couple of the sutras which he uses. The second sutra of Yoga Sutra, which is the famous and the most well-known, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. That yoga, and yoga again to Patanjali, is a kevala avastha, kaivalyam, where that alone remains. It's not, then you might ask, what that? Yeah, that's the problem. When you say that alone remains, you have to know what is that. But then, no, that alone remains. So it's not that giving you a correlate for the that. At the point when all the correlates of that ends, then you experience the real space. So yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga, or the experience of kaivalya, kevala vastu, is when all mind modifications are restrained. And Patanjali goes into a very beautiful taxonomy of different mind spaces, which we don't have time today. Then he says, tada drishtuhu svarupe avasthanam. What happens when all your minds are restrained? When the mind modifications are restrained, then the mind abides in its true nature, in the true nature of the seer. And otherwise, if that doesn't happen, what happens? Then, vritti sarubhyam idaratra. When there is no restraint, the mind identifies with the modifications. There is another important sutra in the fourth chapter, 17th. It says, tat ubaraga apekshitva chittasya vastu jnadam ajnadam. I find it very revealing. It says that knowing and unknowing of an object depend upon its coloring of the mind. The knowing and unknowing of an object depend upon its coloring of the mind. But what is most important in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is the idea of Samyama, which he introduces as the final refinement of the layers of awareness, and what could be the impact of Samyama if you could develop it. And what is Samyama? Samyama is a combination of three states of mental refinement. First, you could loosely translate it as concentration, which is dharana, deshabandha chittasya dharana, which is the exclusive attention on an object. The second is contemplation, which is continued concentration of an object. We fail to even exclusively attend on an object, let alone then continued concentration, right, friends? So that's the second one, which is contemplation, just continued concentration of an object. And the third is samadhi, which is seeing the pure object alone, or the pure object alone remains. Tadeva arthamatra nirbhasam. So dharana, dhyanam and samadhi, these three refined states of seeing the object, and then the object alone stays, and these together are called as samyama. And according to Patanjali, when samyama is practiced, wherever you focus on, there could be a progress in that. And his whole theory of siddhi is again based on samyama. For example, to paraphrase Patanjali, you have a stomachache. You concentrate on your stomachache. You contemplate on it, and then just be the stomachache. Perhaps that might bring a wonder, and you would have less of stomachache, just to give a common day example. What it means is that samyama is an extremely powerful powerful tool to be with yourself, to be with yourself, and also to relate with what you call as your day-to-day experiences. If you look at Indian ways of or Indian approaches to understand consciousness, you could see that there are two paradigms. One is what is given to us, what is already available to us. And the other is what is possible, or what you might call as the transcendent. So there is a pathway defined from what is imminent or what is given to what is possible or what is transcendent. Need not necessarily mean that which is away, but that could include many more things. Another important feature is the notion of adhikari, that especially in the context of consciousness studies, what it says is that the method and approach we adopt to understand consciousness or any subjective component of consciousness is influenced by the aptitude of the investigator. His aptitude, his mental training, his own refinement of his mind, the value systems he adopts, and so on, because you're going to intervene the way you try to understand consciousness. And it's also because, and why it is said that? Because finally, consciousness is not going to stay in one point and call you, come on, I'm staying here, please understand me, and I'm going to stay put here. No, consciousness is going to run. Well, you run behind consciousness and consciousness run behind you. And that's why it's called as it's the most elusive, right? You say that it's so near to us. Well, consciousness is one thing. Finally, that's at least one thing which is so close to me. Then if it is so close to you, then why am I not able to understand it? Because you run behind it. And then consciousness run behind you. It's like a cyclical loop, you know. What I meant to say is that perhaps a very successful theory about consciousness would emerge when we shift our focus from an object-centered approach to a person-centered approach, from an explanation and an event-centered approach to an experiencer and a possibility-centered approach. But then there are two challenges to us, and one is that we are given the impersonal brain, which gives you the possibility of a third-person reducibility. And the other challenge is that we also have our personal experiences, which is impossible to be reduced. So there is a first-person irreducibility in personal experiences. So what could be the future of consciousness studies, or what could be the larger challenges or scope of consciousness studies? Definitely, we would see revolutionary advancements in medical, at least in medical science, brain scanning equipment, and so on. Consciousness studies would be a field not only augmenting neuroscientific, neuropsychological understanding of consciousness, but it would also create and augment what we could boldly today call as spiritual well-being. And another possibility is that the nature of pure objectivity, which is a so-called granted thing in almost all sciences, will be questioned. The question of what will be questioned will be the scientific orthodoxy as well as the philosophical dogma. We would explore new meanings for self-identity. And I think subjectivity, agency, and experience would remain the three challenges of understanding consciousness. And all this will be guided by three methods. First, of course, we cannot get away with explanation. We need to explain what is experienced. We need to have exploration. Exploration not only in a scientific sense, but also a self-exploration. The courage to involve yourself as a part of what you are trying to understand. And finally, to make experience as an integral part of what you're understanding, which is called as consciousness. Thank you so much. So discussion, comments, and are welcome. I've talked for long, so I think. Yes.
Would I be right in concluding that consciousness, when you look as a part of neuroscience description, is a product of neurons? And that's one way of looking at it. And the other thing is that the consciousness is also, there are different levels. One is you can say something is conscious because there is a reflex reaction. That is, there is a neuronal activity. Or the second way of looking at consciousness is being aware of being aware, of awareness. I'm aware of being aware. So that becomes a reflexive thing. The reason I bring this topic up is that it's very important to recognize as to when a being is regarded as being conscious. Because that is one of the biggest problems in the medical side. It goes right from the unborn child to the time when we want to turn the ventilator off on a person. But when you look at the Hindu tradition, consciousness is not looked at as a product of anything. It's always there. And what is regarded as consciousness is actually what we are studying, is only that which is a reflected part of that original thing that has ever existed as reflected through the neuronal activity or the medium. If a medium is suitable, it gives a kind of reflection of it. And that reflection is, again, more an object of study as opposed to being the subject itself.
Yeah, thank you for your comment. I think I will have, since I've talked for long, I would like to hear others and then maybe respond. Yes, Hilary.
I think that's the problem we have in the West. We think consciousness is confined to the brain, and it's very difficult to get people to consider that it might exist outside the actual physical brain and go on after death, or there is something there outside the brain.
Okay.
It all depends upon what you define it. Because when I listened to Colin Blakemore, he defined consciousness in relation to the neurons. Well, the spiritualist looks at, no, we're not looking at, that's not the definition of consciousness. So the two people were talking about consciousness, but each one were defining consciousness totally differently.
Yes, Samantha.
I was just wondering, I'm very interesting how you're cutting across the kind of scientific discipline and the views of the Hindu tradition. I'm wondering how much it is... it seems in a way that the empirical evidence points to a strong correlation between what goes on in the brain and the neurons and so on with our own experiences. Is there a kind of underlying assumption within the scientific world that that matter produces consciousness rather than the perhaps alternatives to that? Because if that's the case, I think it's going to be difficult to kind of reconcile and have a really constructive dialogue between the two different worlds. And I'm wondering whether that is, I mean, you mentioned evolutionary theory a lot, and that seems to be one of the premises underpinning that, is that consciousness does rise from matter, which is one philosophical slant. So would you say that that is an assumption that's there, or are scientists beginning to question whether there might be another causal relationship between consciousness and matter?
And as far as I think science is concerned, they would like to have an empirical correlate for investigating something which is otherwise, you know, you don't have it to place it on the table, so you have to place it on the table, and so you need to have an empirical correlate. And there have been many attempts. One of the attempts which is kind of well known was Stuart Hameroff and Penrose's approach to locate consciousness on the microtubular structure of the neurons. And I don't know how successful it was, but at least when it was published in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, there was some discussion after that.
Mm.
I don't know whether that was a failure or a progress.
It's been picked up.
That's
quite
picked
well,
up.
Thank you for that. I don't know a great deal. But down at the level of the qualia, when we have a non-locality, we tend to think in terms of objects and particles.
Mm-hmm.
But once you go down to the very small, then you cannot pinpoint something as here or there or anywhere, because it's everywhere at the same time. Once we get down to that level, then science and
mm-hmm.
philosophy are coming together. Penrose is the man to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Who's Brian at Liverpool John Moore, sorry?
Lancaster.
If you look at for Brian Lancaster's book from last year or something like that, if you've seen that one at all, Sangeeta in India.
Mm-hmm.
But Brian Lancaster is written very well on that area.
So it's interesting, non-locality is an idea which cannot be completely scientific,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, you know, it still is accepted as a scientific notion.
Mm.
Yes,
just
Jonathan.
Just the original question, I don't think anybody is questioning that. They may say, well, it's very complicated how consciousness, subjective first-person experience emerges out of the brain or how it's related to the brain. But I don't think I've never read any mainstream neurologist or philosopher of mind in the West question that. Even David Chalmers, who introduced this idea of the hard problem of consciousness, as well as, I think, his predecessor, the guy in New York, what's it like to be a bat?
Thomas Nagel.
Nagel.
Mm.
And they're very, although they say we need to understand the subjective nature of consciousness, they're very clear. We don't doubt, however, that whatever consciousness is, it comes from the brain. And they're not going to move on that point. And I think also Christian theologians are also not willing to really move on that point very far. If you look at the history of Christian theology, the theological context in which science emerged, it's also pretty sure that whatever the soul is, the mind is, it's rooted in the body and the brain. I mean, Aquinas said there's no such thing as resurrection, with life after death, without resurrection of the body. And scholars have noted that going back to the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's been a strong theological trend in the West to think whatever consciousness is, it must be rooted in the organization of the brain and the body. So it's a very deep assumption that's quite different than the way Indians approach consciousness.
So they're not really reflecting on their worldview and how it affects their empirical data.
You wanted to add something to it?
I don't know if you came across that program a few months ago on the Siamese twins.
Mm.
One body, two heads.
Mm.
I mean, each of them is aware separately. They've each got their own brain. So just to add that, I mean, that would kind of make me more inclined to sort of locate it down to the brain.
Oh.
Because each of them might have a separate awareness, yet it's the same body.
Mm.
These are loads of other philosophical problems.
I am interested in motor neuron disease. I was associated with the association in Oxford for 10 years, and our chief patron is Stephen Hawking.
Mm.
He, all physical functions have gone, but he produces brilliant scientific discoveries. Mm. Mind, the brain remains active, and many people who get this disease, their lifespan is very short. He is the longest living patient of motor neuron disease. How can you philosophically explain the function of the mind? Till the last minute, the mind is alert, but all other functions are defunct. Can there be an... Because doctors don't want to see the patient because they can't do anything. There is no cure at all. It's all related to neurons. Is there a philosophical explanation?
It's kind of a hard question, but I'm only reminded of another person, Jonathan Call, who has written books like The Still Face and The Marathon, where he talks about, he's a medical doctor who talks about his experiences with dealing with people with different motor impairments, and how he says that how the intervention of positive thinking and inducing willpower, you know, engaging more willpower, even helps you to bring out motor neural progress. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
This brings you to the other thing, is that the phantom limb syndrome, where the limb doesn't exist, but the pain in the limb exists. So you can then locate, say, then the consciousness is in the brain. Because very same thing when they do neurosurgery, and the patient is allowed, the skull is open, and when they stimulate each different part of the brain to find out the safe part to remove for an epileptic patient, they're eliciting sensations. Just by stimulating an area of the brain, the sensation of burning in the toes, or whatever may be the sensation. So where does actually then, how does consciousness relate? Is it only a stimulation of the neurons, or is it the analysis by the neurons of an experience? Because when you look at the other end, where by stimulating certain parts of the brain, you elicit the experience without the experience actually having been there. So in the West, what I would say is how consciousness is defined is very, very different to how in philosophy we define consciousness. And I think until and unless you change the definition, we're going to have great difficulty bringing the two together. It's like having a ladder. There are some rungs that will meet each other, but they will always remain parallel in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's totally correct. That it seems, in one sense, you could say that Indian philosophy and theology just doesn't care about brain science, because it has no reason to care about it, because the self is ontologically distinct from the brain. It has nothing to do with the brain. You know, the Atman reincarnates into a different brain, or to an animal with no brain, and to a deva that doesn't probably have a brain, or something, who knows. But in one sense, the devil's advocate could say, well, why would an Indian theologian care what goes on in the brain at all?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have a couple of issues, unfortunately.
Great, fortunately, it could be.
I hope that the intention is a good one at the end. I think consciousness or consciousness studies or whatever phraseology we wish to use suffers from a sort of perpetual crisis, simply because we're using, if one takes the very basic sort of structures of our language, a verbal noun, an object that in a sense is objects that are conscious exhibit a disposition or an ability to be conscious. The consciousness as a sort of verbal noun gives rise to all sorts of problems, it seems to me, simply because we either wish to define it as a stuff of some kind, as a space of some kind, or we wish to locate it in the brain. Mm-hmm. So the questions of it being a stuff or it being location seem to be errors that arise from the fact this confusion of the verbal noun. For me, the verbal noun is a sort of construct that we've created. But does it refer to an actual state? Is it directed at a state? Because you have this idea, I think, in consciousness studies of first order and second order sort of predicates. You know, the idea that some things, in a sense, indicate other objects. So when we say the self refers to something, it refers to an object. The problem is, though, in consciousness studies, that there are lots of problems. The first problem, I think, that I've identified is that of circularity and regress. In a sense, arguments about consciousness, if such a state exists, if it is indeed a state, leads to an infinite regress. It's a big problem in consciousness studies, this possibility of there being an infinite regress, where you have one thought accompanying another higher order thought, and it just, in a sense, goes on ad infinitum. There's always one other thought greater than the thought that you can think of. And it leads to a sort of a regress. The other problem, I think, is the one to do with the problem of animal and infant consciousness. Are animals and infants, very small, you know, children, conscious? Do they exhibit complex thoughts such as, I am in a mental state M, for example? Yeah, so there's another sort of area of difficulty. And, you know, are these conscious states, do they exhibit conceptual content? When we're talking about reference, when we believe that the nouns that we use, the language that we use, refers to physical objects or to rational objects or to an object of some kind. But do we say that in relation to animals and children as well? Are they sort of conscious of those things? And the third problem, of course, is the one that was raised by Steubenberg, and if you came across his work in 1998. This is the problem of the rock, or sometimes referred to as a generality problem. The rock does not become conscious by my thinking about it. And so, in a sense, that raises a difficulty in trying to identify exactly what a conscious state is, and whether or not objects, in a sense, become conscious through our sort of reasoning or our thinking about them. So it can give rise to what I think is a sort of damaging reductio, where you reduce things down to this sort of based on this sort of level where objects can, in a sense, either enter into conscious states or exit from them on the basis of us thinking about them. The other problems are that of misrepresentation. I can be misgiven, I can be mistaken about who or what a conscious state is, or about who I am. So going back to the first person pronoun causes problems, again, because of the fact that it sometimes doesn't refer. I could be mistaken about who I think I am. In the same way as, for example, this famous example, a lady called Saki, who I think was...
there's a classic example of butterfly thinking there's the king, and the king thinking there's the butterfly.
Indeed, this lady who came off a train and was greeted by somebody and said, "Joey, so you must be the new governess." And she, of course, replied, "Yes, if I must, then I must." But clearly it gives rise to questions, difficulties about how we come to know that, you know, this identification process or this referring procedure that we adopt actually is referring to the thing that we have in mind. So these are just a few of the things I was sort of reflecting on. I'm sorry if I've taken up more of your too much of the time. And then, of course, we have the sort of causal and inferential relations between lower and higher order states. You know, how much of it can be inferred to be a particular state? How much of it is actually a conscious state? The inference is also sometimes, I think, used, isn't it, and debated in the literature. That's really it. You know, those are my concerns.
They're very valid concerns, Nadeem, informed concerns. But I have just few comments. I wouldn't get into a philosophical debate because I know that you are an expert on Wittgenstein others, so I know that you would be able to easily demolish. But as far as neuroscience is concerned, I think there's greater clarity about what is called as a conscious experience, or what could be called as a correlate of conscious experience. And when we try to present consciousness, it's not a state. It's not yet another conscious state, or it is not a grouping of all the conscious states put together and producing something. You don't mean an epiphenomenal entity out of different conscious experiences. In fact, one theory could be that everything else arises from consciousness. So the whole discussion starts, perhaps, according to one theory, that everything is consciousness, and then the rest has to be explained in the context of consciousness. So that's why I think there is an emphasis on personal exploration and so on, and consider its relation with what we would like to call as the being. So it is not an epiphenomenal property, consciousness as such, of many conscious states put together. But I'm not saying that the concerns which you raised can be answered by this question, but I thought at least this clarification should be helpful.
I think this word conscious of something comes up all the time. Can we not separate this I'm conscious of? You said it was a verbal noun, consciousness, and that's something totally different to this verb I'm conscious of. When you were talking about the three, the knower, the known, and the knowing that passes between them, those are the conscious of, but consciousness is a substratum out of which those arise, are sustained by, and fall back into. And consciousness cannot be related to being conscious of something. It's impossible, personally.
Yes, Gopal.
Also, maybe would you think that a difference between the Eastern and Western view in science of consciousness is that the Eastern views, consciousness is not measured in terms of mental states. Because, for example, like the Brahma Sutra, it's described four states of consciousness. One is awake, then dreaming, then in deep sleep, and in a state of coma. And in a state of coma.
The last one?
Coma, yeah. The fourth one is a coma.
Turiya is not coma, Gopal. Turiya cannot be coma. We need to find who the translator is. Well, anyway, coma got elevated, so that's good.
Ramanuja, in his commentary, he writes coma as another state, so I guess there's five states. It was very interesting when I read it. He actually mentioned that, because he differentiates coma from deep sleep. Because he says, once you wake up from a deep sleep, you feel a sense of satisfaction. Whereas when you wake up from a coma, then you feel a state of sort of misery.
Mm.
So, sort of in Indian systems of thought, the state of deep sleep, when all mental activity is completely gone, that's a state of consciousness.
Mm.
And deep sleep is differentiated from death. So in other words, in both cases, one isn't aware of one's existence at that time, but in both states, it states you're conscious. Whereas, for example, like in the work of Daniel Dennett, there's really no difference between a person who's sleeping in deep sleep and a person who's dead in terms of consciousness. Yeah, in terms of bodily activity, there's, but both are, according to him, completely unconscious.
Mm.
So I just thought that was an interesting thing, that how, again, it's like there's a very clear distinction between the mind and the brain and consciousness itself.
Yeah.
How about this thought experiment? If it was possible to cut your head off and allow it to survive, now would that be a conscious?
Yeah.
Is consciousness preserved there? Mm-hmm. Because, including the spinal cord, for sake of clarity, let's say, because spinal cord is an extension of the brain. We take that as well. We see all of this in the cartoon.
I think Ken has a point, but I would only say one thing. I think all those kind of perspectives are still trying to say that the consciousness is in the body.
It's
in the body.
Yeah, it's located.
But when we are trying to say that consciousness is not a state, It is not located somewhere, but it includes everything. Everything else comes from consciousness. I'm sure it's a difficult thing, but
it's a
valid
point. But I mean, as you said, that answers that question quite nicely, because if you say it is located in something, and this, if it, there was a possibility that the brain, with its spinal cord, is allowed to live, you've pumped all the nutrients in it, now would that being be regarded as conscious? Now, it's very difficult to answer that question, but if we looked at matter at some in some kind of configuration, is able to derive a sense of awareness from the consciousness, then we have two different types of consciousness. One is a derived, the other one is the ever existent.
Can I raise a question? Not to, well, just your opinions on We've tended to look at things from a point of view of, say, a Vedantic approach, or a Hindu approach, let's say. But what about the Buddhist angle? Would anybody like to touch on that?
Of course.
And I guess, you know, Lacan, coming up on the same lines as the whole bundle theory, types of things, that there isn't this ever-eternal consciousness. It is a product.
No, he may not say it's a product. He could only say that it's not something static, and you cannot just find it somewhere. You know, when things are like separated, you don't find something between. So it's not.
Go back to Heraclitus in the Western. You cannot step in the same river twice, which
right.
is basically the Buddhist line. So everything is in a state of permanent change, but there's a substratum somewhere. That was Heraclitus' problem, and he came up with a thing called the logos, and that is the substratum, the law which is holding it all together. And this is what quantum mechanics seems to be finding, this, that there is something holding this whole thing together, and it is nowhere to be found.
Nowhere to be
found. Which is what the Buddhists would disagree with, right? I mean, they'd agree with the substratum.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know enough.
That goes very much with the Hindu thinking. It is everywhere, yet it's nowhere to be found.
That's right, yes.
The faster
it outruns pursuit.
Yes. I think there's a branch of speculative philosophy here at the university that looks into that question as well. The idea of, again, self-interest giving away to interest for everyone.
Mm.
Self isn't, again, is a sort of illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you transport a brain, one person X to person Y, into person Y's body, does that brain still, in a sense, value self-interest, or that person value self-interest in the same way? Causes other sorts of problems. So I think it's perfect. I think it's the Parthetian line, which closely resembles the Buddhist position. But that also seems to, again, exterminate the self as the substratum of conscious experience.
The thing you mentioned earlier on about small children and animals.
Yes.
Have you looked at Jacques Lacan and his ideas about how infants develop the sense of I?
Tell me.
Oh, I mean, I have only looked into it a little bit, but I guess you're more of a philosopher, so
what?
Maybe something for you to research on. Sure. But I think, with the way he talks about it, our sense of identity, our sense of I, doesn't come about absolutely from within. It's simply as a negation of everything else, and it's that difference that gives me that gives that sense of I within me. So it's only so if there wasn't anything else, I would have no perception of I.
Does that raise the question in my mind? I mean, aren't the two issues there, the sense of I and consciousness, are they definitely related, or could a animal or child be conscious without having a clear sense of I? So aren't we kind of conflating the sense of I with consciousness?
Indeed.
And I'd say we need to differentiate between those in a sense. I'm not saying they're not connected
indeed.
In some way, but
we
may assume that the identity and the consciousness, or the sense of consciousness, are synonymous, but they may be somewhat different.
And also, in all cases, I mean, cases of amnesia, people, of course, forgetting who they are and having other factors that are around that. Are they also sort of, you know, conscious of being, people are paralyzed halfway down
We wouldn't question they're not conscious if someone had amnesia. But they may have lost that sense of I, or the continuity.
Yes, the sense of I.
Well, there's a whole lot of discussion in Vilayanur Ramachandran's book on different kinds of syndromes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your imagination would have no end if you read that, the kind of syndromes where you fail to recognize yourself, you fail to recognize your own mother, and you think that there's somebody as an imposter acting like your mother. All kind of impairments, yes.
Are we looking at consciousness?
Yeah, so I'm just about to...
On our own terms, in other words, just because the animals can't express consciousness the way we would be able to read it,
so
we are claiming that they are not conscious.
I'll just complete what I said. So, from one point of view, there's enough literature today to understand distinct conscious experiences. What you call a self-identity from a very empirical point of view, with the help of brain impairments and how fragile the whole idea of self is. That's from one perspective. There could be another perspective where the notion of self itself is not brain-centric. It's not brain-centric, it's not body-centric, but could be something which is known when you use your mental capacity and your ability to think, your ability to refine things, perhaps in different ways. So these are equally valid points of view. But we are not talking about a monolithic notion about self, which is easily available to be destructed and which is easily available to be created. I think that clarity should be there.
When death occurs, do the senses, all the senses, go in one go, or some sense remains, that will be the last to go.
I wait to know that.
I was told that the hearing is the last to go.
I see.
Starts ringing in your ears. The time has come.
No, I haven't heard. How can you prove it?
No, sometimes when you see a person die, you see them going back, you know, like the forebrain functions goes until the last bit that is left is the brainstem function. And when that goes, the person goes. Sometimes it all happens very quickly. In some people, it happens in stages. So the medical profession would look at it, what function is left. If it's only the brainstem function is left, which is totally automated, then the person is not regarded technically as conscious, because without any support, they're not going to survive.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There are moves in some sciences, such as religious studies and the soft sciences, to really question the whole idea of positivism, and you know they're looking at the influence much more of the researcher on the research and so on, and questioning whether you can have facts devoid of values, for example. It would seem that you'd need to be going down that route a little to investigate consciousness. In other words, how much are the presuppositions, again, of the investigator going to determine how we evaluate the data?
Yes.
You know, and it seems
to me... In short, what you're saying is purely objective method may not be...
It's not. Well, I don't... I mean, I think it needs to be questioned personally, because I think it's a myth. The idea of pure objectivity, and there are certain disciplines who are coming also to similar conclusions, that actually it's much better I think it's based on the philosophical concept of a critical realism, that we have to reflect on our perceptions of truth, and there's always someone speaking, someone's always evaluating data, and I'm wondering whether or not the scientific world has to... It must be resisting, or some of them must be resisting this idea that they've got, that, you know, the fact is truth, the evidence speaks for itself. Are there moves towards a more reflective approach?
Well, I wouldn't know whether it's reflective, but at least the attempt to include the subjective quality of consciousness into your investigation, I would think it's not a purely classic, in the classical sense, a scientific approach, right? Science would have never interested in including experience as a part of your investigation. But then that's happening today.
I see.
And what I wish to perhaps add here is that I think when we try to understand consciousness or different conscious states, what we are trying to do is not to reduce one particular way of looking at it into another school. You're not trying for mutual reducibility. Mm-hmm. Because it looks like when you follow a particular path, that path leads to certain clarity about what we could call as self, identity, personal well-being, and so on. And the other point is that I think consciousness is one theme where your subjective well-being, values, and so on are so much interconnected. Responsibility, social responsibility, and so on. So I'm not sure whether it is possible to understand consciousness only from and say that, okay, well, this is a valid point of view, and then there's no issue of consciousness, perhaps, if you take this particular point of view. So I think whichever method it is, it tries to reduce consciousness to a very easy matter of explanation, will be committing an old classic scientific error. Mm. That would be my thinking.
Thank you.
Sorry. I had a specific question that lampooned you with about 1,000 different issues. So it was a great talk, but so thank you. I had a question on that same issue. You spoke about the investigator will influence the understanding of consciousness itself. So what do you think? I assume you're talking about the notion of adhikaran, the qualification of the investigator will have some impact on how they understand whatever they're investigating. How do you think that notion from India can contribute to
yes, I understand. Yeah. Well, in a philosophical sense, I think it would help to question any kind of orthodoxy, and especially scientific orthodoxy and sometimes philosophical dogma. Because I think it's very important to keep in mind that the way we try to understand something is definitely going to influence it. And what equipment you have to understand, or the particular approach you take, it could lead you to a valid answer. But to think that alone would be enough to understand something which is much more complex would be, I think, an epistemological error. So the whole idea of adhikaritva not only gives you cues for subjective refinement, it also, I think, questions certain notions about what we consider as objectivity. So that's what I think.
Just a couple of things that Peter Fenwick, do people know? Peter Fenwick is one person. There was some BBC. Neuroscientist. Yeah. Into the Light is a book he did with his wife, whom she is a psychiatrist, on the near-death experiences and what does happen if a person is officially brain dead. And do we know when they report travels and so on, when they're officially brain dead, how are they able to experience those things? You know, I won't chase all that now, but Dr. Peter Fenwick, and it was the man at Southampton.
Clark?
No, the man.
Southampton,
isn't
it?
Sorry?
Southampton, you said?
Yeah, Southampton. There's a consultant down there, the BBC programme that was on.
He does research on that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Dr. Sam?
Sam, yep. Yeah, no, Sam's good word. Right. Unity, that will do. The other one is everybody aware of What the Bleep Do We Know?
Yes.
And Down the Rabbit Hole. No, not too much. Look it up on the web, What the Bleep Do We Know and Down the Rabbit Hole, because that is quantum science.
It's quite controversial also.
Oh, there's a lot of nonsense in it, but you just discriminate the nonsense.
Yeah.
But you'll find Penrose turning up on there.
Stuart Hameroff.
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's the
yes.
book.
Difficult reading.
He's a crystallographer, really.
But this particular movie is very good as far as science education is concerned about brain. Very, very nice visuals. What the blip do, you know? Sure. But a lot of controversies about it. I mean, ridiculed also.
At my personal level, I just feel that first, before we decide, we're discussing consciousness, we need to say, what do we understand by consciousness? Then have the discussion. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are completely lost. You're all over the place. And if you're talking about the consciousness as a functional product of the brain, then that's easy. But then, so are we sticking to that? Or what are we regarding as... See, this is where the problem comes in. It's the functional product of the brain. But then you can quantify it. At what functions you regard as to be true consciousness and what are reflexive.
I think I tried to list a few questions, and what is consciousness was one of the primary questions, which I thought is basic. But then, by saying that, I didn't mean that by defining consciousness, you're exhausting consciousness. And
we don't need to exhaust it.
I'll just complete. So by defining consciousness, you're not exhausting the consciousness. And if you define, let's say I give a definition for consciousness, and then I say that, okay, I'm trying to trace a certain pathway, would that be more accurate? Or I try to give different ways of looking at consciousness, different components of it, different methods, and say that perhaps there are certain other components which could be looked at in certain other ways. Would that be complementary?
One is you can look at this as a definition, or the other part is that consciousness, you can't define it, it's a metaphor. So it is something like this, it's something like that. And
well, it's a metaphor.
James, I can't remember who the thing. This consciousness is like a river; it flows at different levels, and also it's a metaphor. So we can only have an approximation. So
well, William James talks about a whole lot of things. He talks also about certain qualities of what is mystic experience. You would know that, which again is very exciting to read. But to get back to what the comment which you made, that unless you define consciousness and then mark a path from that, consciousness will be all over. And that's my point. Yeah, consciousness is all over.
And then, of course,
that's my point.
I think, again, the big problem that keeps sticking.
And it's impossible to get out of it.
Not just impossible, but also the fact that we're not immune to error through identifying a conscious state incorrectly.
Yeah.
We can do so. We can identify what we believe to be a conscious state, but incorrectly. So it's the possibility of error which causes a philosophical problem. I was just thinking of something here that I was reading earlier on. Thomas Nagel, you mentioned. And this little sentence here, I'll just read it. I think it's very simple. It's not too complicated to understand. He says, I can conceive impersonally my house burning down, and the individual, Thomas Nagel, TN, standing before it, feeling hot and miserable, and looking hot and miserable to bystanders. If I add to all of this the premise that I am Thomas Nagel with these conscious thoughts, I will imagine feeling hot and miserable, seeing the sympathetic bystanders, etc. But, and this is the important part, he says, but this is not to imagine anything happened differently. In other words, I could be mistaken that I am hot and miserable. If I add this additional person, this additional conscious person to the equation, it doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't identify accurately the person standing before the house. So the possibility of error is a very real one. This is not to deny, of course, the Dante perspective, its own excellence, which I believe it is, but in a sense it's to make sure that we've got the grammar correct before we begin to philosophize, in a sense, is to ensure that we understand what reference is, what identity is, and whether or not the particular states, whatever states these are, actually do refer to the objects that they intend to speak about.
I completely agree with you, Nadim, but if their approach is more epistemological in nature, But if the approach is meditative in nature, then definitely the rigor needs something, which is needed is something different. So I'm not trying to say what you said is not correct, but to think such a clarity would bring the clarity for the whole idea is reducing something which is much complex into one way of looking at it. A linguistic clarity about the components of consciousness as far as a personal noun and so on.
Personal pronoun, you know, what does the personal pronoun do? What does it pick out?
Yeah. Certainly it is valid. But what I'm saying is that when you take a different approach, like for an approach of reflective approach, perhaps the problems could be different, of a different nature. So epistemological clarity need not be a clarity as a whole. Yes, Dr. Giri, I know. I think Jonathan has to keep the time now.
Everybody seems to exist in this whole universe. Does consciousness cease to exist as well?
Sorry, what?
If all beings cease to exist in the universe, does consciousness cease to exist?
Yeah, well, I think the idea is at least this subject should give us a few minutes to keep silent and to go inward. If at least consciousness studies fails in that, I think any serious inquiry is going to have trouble. Because we can ask 101 questions into this subject. But if it is not going to help us to look back at your own self and look at the importance of reflection, quietude of mind, and certain observance of values, certain observance of epistemological rigor, I agree with you, then I think we will still waste a whole lot of time asking many 101 questions without a little bit clarity and without being part, without contributing to it. Because in case, if you are wishing to contribute to this study, then I think we need to be more responsible in understanding the method and what is your own part in it. Is it only by asking more and more questions or methods or I'm not saying that questions should not be asked, but I think we need to be more responsible and we need to be a little more patient, I think. Jonathan.
Should we end there?
Thanks,
Sangeeta.
Thank you so much for all of you for coming from very different places.
It just occurred to me, if you were around tomorrow, I could perhaps try and get... are you here tomorrow?
I'm here. Tomorrow is... I'm there in the centre.
My brother-in-law ran to you, he lives always next door.
Oh, okay.
He'd love to meet you. And also, I could perhaps try and get Rita. But how do I contact you now? Today?
Or I can give you a call, because where I stay, unfortunately, the phone is on a common space, and
right.
Where it rings, I don't hear in my
room.
I see. But if you tell me a time, I can give you a call.
Why not come anyway for coffee?
Okay.
I'll invite Ranji and Rita. I can't guarantee
you. Mean tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow Saturday.
Yeah.
Come for
but tomorrow we don't work. Tomorrow is Saturday.
I know. Come to our
house. So I will be where I stay, so somebody can pick me up.
Okay.
From
there. Where do you,
that
give,
is.
Do you give us your? I think maybe you gave me your address. But I'll come and pick you up and have coffee anyway.
Yeah, okay.
And if Ranji, I'm sure he can come, and Rita, I'll ask.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, at least come and have a coffee anyway to our house.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Because it'd be lovely. Something occurs there. And also, by then, I would have spoken to Amanda, my cousin.
Yeah, okay.
She's very keen.
This is 107 Banbury Road.
Yes. I can't put it away.
Yeah, it's actually Banbury Road,
yeah.
And here actually there's something called not here, but Rowlandson Road.
Yes, yes.
So it is just in this junction.
Yes,
not
opposite. Yes.
Rowlandson Road.
I know.
You are from here,
I,
sir.
I was brought up north. Yes, exactly. Brilliant. Yes.
Yeah. So if you tell me a time, I'll just stand below.
Okay. See, 11 o'clock?
11 o'clock.
Is that a good time?
Yeah.
11 tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Give me your phone number just in case you're... Oh, no, that's no good, is it?
Yeah.
But... I'll be there.
No, I can give you a call at 10:30. Would you like me to give you a call at 10:30?
There's no problem, but
there's
just in case. No, but you do have my number anyway.
I do have your number. You gave me in that.
Yes, I do have your number. It's a fascinating talk just now. The only problem is that I'm not. I don't have the knowledge.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
what you were talking about is fascinating, but there's so much knowledge in this room that it's completely.
Mind-boggling, right?
It's mind-boggling, yes. But I learned quite a lot, actually. Yeah. I mean,
thank you, Trevor, for coming.
No, it's great. I really, really enjoyed coming. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been really great to meet you.
So tomorrow at 11, you
11.
Said, right?
I'll be there at 11,
yeah.
My car.
So I will stand down at the junction.
We think earlier, if you like. Is 11 a good...
You tell me a time, I'll be there. 11 is fine for me, or... Tomorrow is...
Yes, it makes it 11.
I'll be there at 11. I'll be standing there at
11. Yes, wonderful. Lovely.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's a wonderful talk. Your sort of
Publish it if I do posthumously. Well, I think, but I mean, at least in the Hindus, I know most Hindus don't even identify. I mean, they sort of know that the word Hinduism is sort of a British term put on them, and it's really not what their philosophy or religion is about. So that
you say that
some people would appreciate it. Yes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a lot of studies done on that, but within the academic circles. But with the Sikh identity thing. No, it's not been done there simply because Sikhs want to maintain this distinction and they want to emphasize this distinction. The irony is that when this distinction really came into being massively, came to exist in the first place, it was around the late 1800s. The irony of it is that the political group that came up, Singh Sabha, their manifesto was Hum Hindu Nahi. I think, look at the irony, you're defining yourself by what you're not. I mean, not by what you are.
Right.
So that means you don't actually have a self-identity.
Yeah.
So, it's
and so who are you doing this under? So
Professor Shackle.
Shackle.
Yeah? He's a giant.
He's a giant. Giant, oh,
yeah. Slightly physically, but certainly intellectually.
Who's the lady there, Masul? Is that I just know her. I don't know
who Shackle. Yeah, no, Shackleton is more with Sikh stuff.
SOS has a good program.
You know, things have kind of gone down in SOS last year, with the cultural level stuff. It's more legal stuff's okay, politics and all that is going up. But the actual real, that real stuff, I think a lot
of
people...
most places in the world. I mean, everywhere in the world, it's like all the cultural art stuff going down in science.
The thing is, the old school type teacher, lecture, like gradually retired. Rupert Snell, who teaches up Hindi, he retired last year. Shaku retired this year. Vanda Mansky, one good law.
And they're not replacing them.
Because it's a different generation.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, they're not the kind of, they're deciding to axe that course.
Yeah, so then, you know, all the sciences, they're just, that's how people study really these days. Engineering and physics and all these things.
I did, my first degree was in maths.
Same here, I was in engineering before.
Correct.
And I thought that's good also, but you know,
yeah.
why, I mean, this part of life is so important to me, this part of it.
And you come across people dealing with the studies that we're dealing with now, like at SOAS, because my brother did engineering too, and then he did his master's at SOAS, right?
Uh-huh.
And you get people over there, I mean, obviously, we're able to deal with both the scientific side and yet the humanities as well. But for those who are only able to do one, not the other, they're very, very jealous.
Mm.
Not in a nasty way, they're very envious in a kind of, like, oh, that's great, we wish we could be scientific like that. I'm saying, guys, it's actually overrated. It's not all that.
I guess so, yeah. On the other hand, I've also sort of seen a slight discrimination in that, those who are pure theologians or purely in the arts, they can often look down upon those who are coming from sciences.
In the sense that they go, oh, okay, that guy's a scientist, and he's not thinking of
it. Actually, yeah, I guess I kind of do that sometimes. Having given up my maths background.
Yeah, I've seen it definitely here in Oxford. It's like, that's how I don't tell people here that I have a background in engineering.
Okay.
As soon as they hear that, then they're like, okay, well, this guy's sort of a science sort of guy.
Because it's so awesome. You say, you tell him that, you know, you've done maths or engineering.
Like,
wow, you can do that. We can't even do that. We can't think like that. You need
to go over there, mate. You'll be held as a god.
So is Gio here?
Yeah, his stuff is here.
And have you put it off? Give it to Shaunaka, please.
Okay, yeah.